Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR, the best of public radio. I'm Jay Allison of Transom.org, a public media showcase and workshop. Studs Terkel died in 2008. He remains Transom's patron saint. Sydney Lewis, an editor at Transom, worked with Studs for decades at WFMT in Chicago and on many of his books. In the next hour, she talks with Studs' other colleagues as they reminisce about working with Studs.
Oh, you're listening? Oh, you want to get levels? We're talking about where did your words go? All right. How does this sound?
The first time I met Studs, I was new to Chicago. I was working at The Quiet Night, a legendary Chicago nightclub, and there was a benefit for the Wobblies. Studs Terkel was in my sections. So I went to take his drink order, and he instantly started interviewing me. Oh, I was new to Chicago. How long had I been here? What did I think of the city? Did I know who the Wobblies were? I said, industrial workers of the world. Oh, you know that. Oh, that's good, kid. He liked that. So we chatted for a while, but, you know, it was a good turnout, and I had other people to serve, so I was trying to get his drink order, and he kept talking. Finally, I said, Mr. Terkel, I read working. I loved working, but I am working. What do you want to drink? I was too new to know that, of course, he wanted a martini. A few years after that first meeting, I became the secretary in the program department at WFMT, where he had his show. Studs always took the bus to work. His route was through this 3 high-rise, huge, long concourse full of shops and kiosks. And here's tape that 2 German documentarians shared with me from a piece they did on him. This is him in the concourse. He always called it Zombie Canyon.
Zombie Canyon, like a train caller. You have train callers, don't you? They, when they caught the trains leaving? No response. There could be 20 kids going by. Oh, we passed the restaurant nearby where the kids were cheering when Libya was bombed.
Sometimes I'd happen to come right after him, and I would just love to follow him and watch him. And he would be with books under his arm, waving his hands, addressing all the regular shop people and shoeshine guys and everybody.
Say, another day.
Another triumph.
Another triumph. You hear that? Another day. See, he and I agree, and his friend Bob.
That's right.
And we agree. He just come out. You feel a little better now.
And
every day I say, because we're here, I say, another day. And what do you say?
Another triumph.
Another triumph.
That's right. This is Mr. Chicago. The things he stands for and the things he have did for this city.
After Studs talked his way through the concourse and the lobby, went up into the elevator, he'd get to the office. And when he got to work, everybody knew, because the elevator doors would open and his gravelly voice would emerge before his little body. You'd always hear him coming because whatever was going on in his head, he shared with the world at large. I worked with Studs for 25 years. My colleague, Associate Program Director Lois Baum, worked with him for 45, the entire time the Studs Terkel Hour was on WFMT.
A film opened a couple of days ago at the Loop Theater, the producers, directed and written by Mel Brooks.
Here's Lois talking about the early days.
At first, all I did was make a schedule for the control room so that we could avoid the typical traffic jams we had every day, because Studs would come in with someone and command it as if it was his space shuttle, you know, that only he could live in.
For the most part, he was lovely to his colleagues, gracious, friendly, considerate. But when he was working, he was all concentration, and he'd get really impatient if anything interfered with his focus. George Drury worked in the library and would often help Studs.
I wound up having most to do with him getting to know him by working with his collection and finding things for him. By his own definition, he was a private person, but as a worker, he was really quite open. He didn't take every suggestion, but I've often thought about how if he was looking for a record or a tape, that was a chance to sometimes suggest something that he might include. His door was open.
The space around him was always, like, to me, the inside of his mind, just full of things. You could lose people in that room.
Records would pile up on the floor. Books would pile up on the desk and slither off onto the floor.
He got a ton of mail.
And mail,
as you know,
everywhere.
Manuscripts and
I would find letters that he hadn't answered, sometimes not even always opened, that were years old. And it was heartbreaking because they were beautiful letters.
People would just send him out of nowhere, their life story. Could you read this, Mr. Durkle?
The only copy of it.
Always.
Yeah, and this is the only copy. Be sure and send this back to me.
Was it once a year or twice a year? Tried to dig him out.
Once a year.
Yeah.
But it was always really painful. I mean, you could feel that it just sort of hurt him to come into the office and see the desk, as opposed to see 5 inches of pile.
Yeah, he would suffer that for a day and be back in the right direction.
As George said, Studs was really open to suggestions. And one day, George brought in some poems, asked if Studs would just come in the control room and read some poetry.
Yeah, that's it. We got old Tom McGrath. Oh, Gone Away Blues. Oh, well, we got that one, of course. A couple of more here, too. Gone Away Blues by Thomas McGrath. Sirs, when you are in your last extremity, when your admirals are drowning in the grass-green sea, when your generals are preparing the total catastrophe, I just want you to know how you cannot count on me. I have ridden to hounds through my ancestral halls. I have picked the eternal crocus on the ultimate hill. I have fallen through the window of the highest room.
Studs used to talk about how he wanted to be a concierge. When he was young, first his ailing father, and then after he died, his mother ran the Wells Grand Hotel, which was a rooming house kind of hotel. And this was during the Depression. He didn't suffer greatly during that time, but he saw this lobby full of unemployed, underemployed people who were stressed out, and it gave him an opportunity to really learn a lot about other people's suffering. Here again is George.
He grew up in a hotel. And that openness to sort of all comers and a desire to accommodate people as best he could made him unique in my experience of somebody with that kind of reputation in terms of being willing to talk to people. Even when he picked up his phone messages, he would hold forth on the phone message.
I helped Studs deal with a constant flood of phone calls, tons of mail. I fetched coffee for guests and whatever else I could do to help him, including some transcribing for his books. I could kind of keep up with his stream of consciousness, rapid fire delivery, and decipher his hieroglyphics, as he called them. He took to calling me his amanuensis. I took to calling me his nanny. It was kind of like working with a hyperactive 3-year-old. Very demanding, very creative, very playful. He loved to improvise. And he had done a lot of that on his television show, Studs Place, which aired live, actually. Again, Lois.
They were not reading from a script. They had not had a script. They had simply talked through the program ahead of time and decided what the basic bare bones structure of it was to be, and they were improvising.
It's just a little place in the neighborhood, and the people you meet there are, well, let's drop in and see what sort of people are around tonight.
Gee whiz, fellas, my dad gave me this almost a year ago, and he said, Gracie, remember the habits of thrift I've taught you. Never open a bank until it's full.
What you gonna do with all that money, Gracie?
After what you with the nickels in there.
Okay. What you gonna do with all them nickels, baby?
Nickel taste and nickel earned.
What you gonna do with all them nickels, baby?
What you gonna do with all them nickels? Save up and buy a jar of sweet and sour pickles.
Babe of mine.
Apparently people used to write thinking Studs' place was an actual place that they wanted to be there. And then I think of the work that he did hosting the I Come For to Sing, being the MC for that and traveling around with Big Bill. For such a distinct person, he really did do well in ensemble settings.
But also, he just loved to be the center of attention. Again, Lois Baum.
When we would go to movies, a group of us together some evening, and then go out for dinner afterwards, he loved to replay certain scenes in the movie, and he would stand up in the restaurant and start acting out a whole scene. And if any of us let our attention drift, he would say, pay attention here, I'm trying to show you. Listen, look, watch this again. And it was a little annoying after a while because he was really sort of hamming it up. But he loved to do that. It was a big part of his life.
Wasn't that a little regular feature of his riffs, too, where he'd go, I'm Jimmy Cagney in White Heat.
Yeah.
I'm Charles Aznavour and Shoot the Piano Player.
I would love when he'd come in every morning and go, what do you hear? What do you say, kid? You know what movie that's from? Day after day.
He came in one day. He had seen Death of a Salesman the night before and he liked Dustin Hoffman's performance, but he had coached him to make Willie Loman more dapper. He really enjoyed that, and of course he'd been an actor, and that helped the show.
Both on radio and in the theater in
and the movies. When he was in Harriet Arnos, the Dollmaker with Jane Fonda, the fact that he couldn't drive and he was playing a cab driver was resolved by they pushed the taxi to make it move. He was at the wheel. A wonderful reader aloud of stories. If he liked a particular story, he would really get into it.
You know, if he had an author, he would always have some music to introduce or set the mood.
Which he could do wonderfully when he read short stories and would play just the right piece of music. I've never heard anyone else do it as well.
There was a loud guffaw from the bank, and Mr. Paradise shouted, "Ha! Cure the afflicted woman of the hangover!" and began to beat his knee with his fist.
It would be anything. It could be a piece of music, music of any kind. It could be a poem, mm-hmm. or an excerpt from a play or a novel.
Or a previous show.
Or a previous show.
This is Hearing Voices, and you're listening to Working with Studs, hosted by Transom.org editor and longtime Studs Terkel collaborator, Sydney Lewis.
As an observer watching you do some of those programs, uh-huh. it involved a lot of muttering to yourself and
yeah.
diving into the record library.
Yeah. And so I do that too. See, find a record. Suddenly it occurred to me a piece of music would fit this. See, well, certainly St. Jacob Lawrence, he's describing the Harriet Tubman panel on the Captain of the Underground Railway, Escaping Slade. Well, sure, I find a spiritual. Did My Lord Deliver Daniel? Or in the case of 900 Days, Harrison Salisbury describing the incredible siege of Leningrad for 3 years, how they survived. How they survived. They survived through music. And the one voice they heard on all more of the telephone poles was from this radio station in the midst of eating horse meat or whatever they could find on the street, eating grass. They'd hear these Pushkin poems. They'd hear Chekhov's dialogue. They'd hear music. They'd hear Beethoven, Mozart, Mussorgsky. So I'd slip that in.
And then he would come and run it by anybody who would listen to
yeah.
him, you know,
practice
to
it.
Say, what do you think of this?
Yeah, and he had a terrific record collection. Many of the discs lightly dusted with cigar ash.
Studs just loved music. He loved music. Opera, ragtime, blues, all of it. And he was kind of like a jazz musician in the way he would put his show together. Readers got a taste of his musical knowledge when he did the book And They All Sang, a collection of WFMT music interviews that I helped him with. One person he championed on his program was gospel singer Mahalia Jackson. They performed together and became really good friends. Here he is talking about the very first time he heard her sing. He was in a record store.
And it's 1954, about there. What am I talking about? It's 1947, 48. And this guy behind the counter, George Haver, who's a jazz critic, listen to this record, 78. There are two other peoples in the store, yeah. Suddenly we hear this record, that Mildred Falls piano that is so essential to. And those all four of us were transfixed for the 6 minutes. The other two had a record in their hands, never moved. All four of us were statues listening.
Monday morning, soon morning, gonna lead up a cross, get me a crown.
Well, he was such a, always seemed that he was so extemporaneous, but, you know, we all know he had those little index cards that he had all kinds of quotes on and notes on. I realized after a while that half the time that he was wandering up and down the hallways, he was practicing.
He really enjoyed the process. I mean, you could tell just by the way he was pacing in his office or in the hallway. And sometimes you'd hear the same speech several times.
He'd do little riffs. One I really enjoyed was he was walking up and down the hall one day, and he was really taken with the phrase, "My uncle got hit by a train, so to speak." And he loved the "so to speak" part. But he would practice.
I mean, he was great just at the drop of a hat, but he put a lot more work into it than one would have thought.
Yes, and that goes better if you have a basis for it. You know,
right.
He had a tremendous fund of knowledge.
Studs would never interview someone if he didn't know the work of this person.
By all means, preparation. But once you're prepared, you improvise. It's in my head by that time. Or I got those notes, those crazy notes in the book. Look through. So it gets kind of exciting. So my guest, he gets a kick out. She get a kick out of it. That's how I work.
It was really fun to go by his office and see him lying on his couch reading.
It was always really satisfying to see authors look at the copy of their book that he had his hands on.
They loved it. Authors loved him.
Oh, just to see all the markings and to see that he had really, really read it.
To the last page.
I read the book. As you know, a writer's got a kick out of being on my show, but see, my book is all marked up page and page and hieroglyphics that I can hardly understand, you know. And so those, or I know the music of the person I'm with, or watch the paintings go through the gallery.
The other day I found his working copy of Rosalind Carter's autobiography, and it's just a fabulous document. It has gone through page by page with all these wonderful notes, read, discuss, recount, and these lines drawn from one part of text to the next one. As you know, that was what he did with any book that he read. And I associate the actual sound of his program with warmth. You know, he always talked about the feeling tone, that that's what he was looking for. And he had what he was looking for.
Bessie Smith, of course, the Empress of the Blues, singing of a disaster, of a flood. Sitting with me, hearing Bessie Smith on this recording, is James Baldwin, brilliant young American writer. He is one of the rare men in the world who seems to know who he is today. And as you listen to this, Jim, to this record of Bessie Smith, what's your feeling?
It's very hard to describe that feeling.
The feeling tone was something that he gave each of his programs, and it didn't matter who the guest was. Studs was able to find the voice of each of these people and allow it to be heard on the program in ways that, especially today, many interviews do not successfully do. And when you look at the broad range of people that he spoke with, it's clear that he did have this gift, because he always brought out the real voice of the people. And I still have these voices in my head. I hear the cadences of their voices and the thoughts that they shared with him and us as listeners.
So I see radio as saying that which is unsaid, but felt. So to the listener, hearing that, there's no question there's a leap. You hear stuff you haven't heard before, that someone says, a stranger or someone you know, well, that's, yeah, I am connected with somebody. That's what I was thinking of.
By the time I left WFMT, I had become Studs' main transcriber, and we continued working together for the rest of his life. When publisher Andre Schifrin saw print versions of some of Studs' radio interviews in the WFMT program guide, he invited Studs to do an oral history portrait of Chicago, which became the book Division Street America. Studs always said he owed his book career to Andre Schifrin. They worked together for 40 years.
For everyone who's interested in American history or in the American past, he brought out stuff that no one had realized. I mean, the very simple stuff that in the Depression people felt responsible for their plight, that they felt guilty about being jobless. All of that is a key to not just to the Depression, but to the situation now. And historians hadn't written that. They had missed that because they weren't really talking about the way ordinary people felt. The stuff he discovered on the Second World War, about the race war within the war, about the fragging, about the conflicts and so on, all of that had been there for people to discover before. And they hadn't. It hadn't followed the official line of American history. So Studs, you know, was subversive in that respect. He discovered things that others should have discovered. And as I've often said, you know, he explained America to the Americans as much as to the foreigners.
Here's Studs at 90 talking about his approach.
Let's be political for a moment. You can't avoid it. The Bertolt Brecht poem, he asks, who built the seven gates of Thebes? Who did it? Was it kings, queens? If I would ask people about the pyramids, the immediate reaction is, well, the pharaohs built. Pharaohs didn't lift a finger, you know, Mrs. Pharaoh. His hands were as immaculately manicured as Elizabeth Taylor and Cleopatra, you know. When the Chinese Wall was built, where did the Masons go for lunch? When Caesar conquered Gaul, was not even a cook in the army? And the big one is when the Spanish Armada sank. Now, I remember the year 1588. I remember that as well as I do 1492 and 1776. Because that's when I was told Sir Francis Drake conquered the Spanish Armada. He did, by himself. Brecht writes, when the Armada sank, we read that King Philip wept And here's the big one. Were there no other tears? History should be about those who shed those other tears.
They were an unlikely pairing. The refined, French, internationally admired publisher and the very American, rambunctious radio guy. Andre lived in New York. Studs lived in Chicago. Andre was very soft-spoken. Studs was already very hard of hearing. Communication could be a little difficult, but it worked. It worked really well.
The ways in which we worked together changed because the very first book, we kept one word in 10. I mean, we really did massive cutting. And then afterwards, he cut back more and more.
Studs referred to the process as prospecting for gold.
That's what he called it, and he was quite right. I mean, we really did get rid of all the extra stuff. The books were very clearly the delineation of what was the heart of each interview. And, of course, that did not affect the content of the interview. I mean, the whole point, for instance, of the interviews and working is that everybody hated their work, I mean, without exception. And after, like, 99 interviews, I said to Studs, we've got to find somebody who likes their work. And I suggested a friend of mine who worked in advertising and who was a very funny, caustic, sarcastic guy who I thought would bring a little humor to the book. And so I sat with him in some bar in New York. Studs started talking to him. And by the end of the interview, the man was so close to tears that they both retreated to the men's room so that the guy could cry in private and tell Studs how he really felt about the frustrations of his job. It wasn't any good in terms of finding light relief for the book, but it was a marvelous example of how Studs could really get to people who this man I had known, you know, since college days. He'd always been the wittiest and funniest guy in the room. And when Studs started getting to him and to really talk, he showed his true colors. And we finally did find a stonemason who liked his work. But certainly no one was trying to pretend to Studs or trying to make believe that they were great at their work and enjoyed it or any of the usual pretenses that people have when they're talking about themselves. And as you know, his most proud comment was with one of his interviewees who said at the end of the interview, gee, I didn't know I felt like that.
This is Working with Studs. Produced by Transom.org, a showcase and workshop for New Public Radio, our tribute to Studs Terkel, America's greatest listener, continues in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are Hearing Voices. This hour, Working with Studs, the late, great Studs Terkel.
In the work I do, interviewing different people, the ordinary so-called, which is a phrase I dislike because it's patronizing, ordinary, they've been capable of extraordinary things. But this woman, I use all the time. This is the first book, Division Street America. It was a public housing project, and it was integrated, all poor. And I can't remember if she was white or black. She was pretty. I remember she was pretty skinny, and with four little kids running around. And at the tape recorder was not the ubiquitous tool it is today. It was new, and she'd never been interviewed before. And the kids are hollering, I want to hear Mama. I said, just a minute. So I play it back, and as she hears her voice, but she put her hand to her mouth and says, oh, my God. Well, what is it? She says, I never knew I felt that way before. Bingo. That is fantastic to her as well as to me.
But Harrison Salisbury, who was, you know, one of the Times' great reporters, said to me after his interview with Studs that, you know, he'd never written anything as good as his interview with Studs had been. So whether it was, you know, high and low, or people who weren't articulate or people who were too articulate, he was able to get to the root.
Andre was his main and final editor. But fresh eyes are always a good thing, and they would have other editors look at early drafts of any manuscript. Studs was already known in the publishing world when a young editor named Tom Englehart came to work for Andre. And one day Andre gave Tom the new Terkel manuscript and said Studs wanted his opinion. And Tom thought, well, you know, he just didn't take it that seriously. So he didn't get to it right away. Couple days pass, and there's Andre back at Tom's door.
Studs really wants to know what you think. He's anxious about it, so you have to do it. So I went home, I read it. A day or two later, I had to call Studs.
And you and I know what was happening when Andre kept coming in and going, have you finished it yet? Studs was calling him twice a day.
That's right. But at that time, I didn't know it. I couldn't even imagine that Studs would care what this unknown editor would think. So it was an illuminating moment for me because I got him on the phone, and Studs immediately says, Tom, what did you think? And his voice is shaking. It was one of those lessons I took away that it doesn't matter who you are as a writer, when your thing has gone in, well-known, unknown, whatever. That was the way I met Studs, with his voice shaking on the phone while I was there to tell him that, in fact, he had done a wonderful book, which, of course, as always, he had. I mean, he got better at what he was doing, as we all do, but he was always a novice. We would always, at the beginning of a book, have that call, and have that call a number of times. He had to be reassured. It was good. He was doing okay. And he really needed that. It wasn't just a tick. It was something deep. For a man who, in other situations, seems so totally and utterly in control in his own work, once it came to that moment, he actually felt out of control. He had to know from you that it was okay. And that was kind of moving, actually.
Again, Andre Shiffrin.
And he always had to have a book in the works. I mean, that was something I realized very early, that before the book was finished, we had to start work on something else, because otherwise he would be terribly depressed. You know, he would worry about it in exactly the same way with every book. You know, what would the critics say? But as long as there was another book in the works, he could manage the tension and the uncertainty.
His anxiety never paralyzed him, though. He was too busy working. Between doing his radio show 5 days a week and always collecting interviews for whatever the next book was, he had plenty to do, and sometimes he had places to go. And he would take the bus or a cab, but when he couldn't, because he couldn't drive, he would have to enlist help. One such person who helped him was Tony Judge. He'd been hired from out of town to be the new sales manager. And when he came to work at WFMT, he was already a Turkle fan.
I moved to Chicago, and there was Turkle down the hall, this man, this odd man with an armful of books and the rubber bands and the clothing and the cigar and the noise and the crazy office and people coming and going, people who I often was just astounded to see come through those doors and go into a studio with Studs Terkel, people I admired all my life, writers and artists.
Arthur Miller, distinguished American playwright, memoirist, and for that matter, president of PEN, the International Writers Congress. This memoir of yours, which is your life, in a way, it's also the life of our society to a great extent, isn't it?
I didn't think that people any longer remembered what the hell had happened in the last 30, 40 years. And I met people of my own generation who couldn't remember.
So not very long after Tony started, Studs had an East Coast trip planned. And he was doing interviews for American Dreams Lost and Found. And somehow it didn't bother the brass that the new sales manager, Tony Judge, was going to take a week off to work as Turkle's driver.
Off we went. And I'm driving this hero of mine from place to place. And I couldn't have been more thrilled about this.
Okay, so you're spending all this time with him.
Yes.
And as you and I know, he never stops talking.
Well, he never stopped talking. And of course, I was mostly delighted. I mean, this was the richest stuff you can imagine. I was hearing things I'd always wanted to hear, didn't know I wanted to hear them, but stories and reminiscence and wonderful stuff of theater and remembrance of movies and the stuff that he was so terrific about. But we finally, after a couple of days, and end up in a place in Maine, and it was late, and we'd been drinking, and we went in to sleep. It was like in Moby Dick, it was Queequeg and Ishmael, and in the sense that the woman said, well, we do have a room, sir, but there's only one bed. It didn't seem to bother him, and I said, well, okay, sure. So Turkle and I've only known him a month or so, end up in this bed together. And he's smoking a cigar, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we've had 77 martinis, and he's bap, 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 bap. And I finally remember thinking, I wish he'd shut up. I think I've said that, but actually I was delighted. Because I was the driver, I mean, this was complicated in a way, and it was interesting how well it worked. Because these people often, some of them, of course, knew of Studs Terkel, but others really had no idea exactly who this guy was or what the purpose was, but they certainly must have been anxious about this. And so this shambling sawed-off man with his odd clothing and his crazy machine under his arm would show up at the door, speaking a patois that sometimes is hard to sort of figure out, with his big galoot pal behind him, I mean, Mutton Jeff, and there I'd be, sort of shuffling my feet and wondering, should I be intruding on this? But he'd find a way of saying, well, this is, you know, Tony, he's good. And I'd be invited often to come and sit in the corner, and I'd try to get far away from the action. But listen to this. And so often, I ended up rapt by what was going on.
I used to tease Studs, how do you get such good interviews? You never stop talking. And then he interviewed me for one of his books. He focused so thoroughly on you. It felt like he reached inside you. Again, Andre Shiffrin.
People felt that he wasn't out to get them or trap them or anything. He wasn't looking for the gotcha moment. Also, he was respecting their privacy. As you know, Studs never talked to anyone about their personal relationships, about sex, about any of those issues, which in a way was a shame because some of them would have been interesting in some of the interviews. But he was leaving their private area to be private.
Sometimes they're personal things you don't pry into. By the way, you notice none of my stuff is intimate. That is, it's nobody's business but their own. So I never have that prurient stuff. There's no need for that. People, those who are called celebrities one way or another, I rarely do that. I interview someone who is known because of that person's artistry. This was Diana Barrymore, and she was news a lot because men and booze and drunkenness, and she was in the headlines. However, I saw her in a Tennessee Williams play suddenly last summer as the girl, and she was fantastic. So I interviewed her for her role. And ask a bit about her father, memories perhaps, not the prurient stuff. And so we have a talk about this girl at the road. She hosted Maggie and Cat on the Hot Tin Roof very well. And she's talking about these Tennessee Williams heroines and a whimsical story about her father. And at the end, near the end of the interview, you could see she was quite moved. I was too. Haven't you forgotten something? You didn't ask me about my, about your what? What about my troubles that all the papers... That's none of my damn business. Your art, what you do, tells me who you are. What you did as that girl, or what you did as Maggie on Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, tells me, to me, all I need to know about you, that you're a marvelous actress in certain roles. And then she starts crying. And next day, I get a box of cigars saying, thank you, Diana. That was all. So that's what I mean.
And, you know, I think that happens so rarely. I mean, a lot of people have tried to do what Studs has done, and very, very few of them have succeeded. That was his ability. I mean, when he talked to people who'd been in the KKK, who you would have thought would have been difficult to interview for him, he would got through to the reasons why they were what they were, and the weaknesses that they had felt, and the hurts that they had felt. And he got a full picture, in a way, that other people hadn't been willing to do.
None of it would have added up to much if Studs hadn't been such a fantastic editor. Again, Tom Engelhart.
The interviews that you see in those books are very much reorganized interviews. I mean, I read all the raw data, and, you know, he'd often yak and yak and yak, and then he'd find some starting spot, and then we'd reorganize the interviews accordingly. And, you know, a raw interview would not, if you read it on the page, read like your experience of a conversation at all. What Studs was great at was creating an analogy to the experience he had had in a much shorter space and in a much more succinct way with the words of that person. And he was great at that. But it is an analogy, really.
Again, Andre Shiffrin.
I've often said the key to Studs' ability was that people felt he respected them. They understood the empathy. They were willing to talk to him, even if they totally disliked what he stood for, because they knew he was going to listen to them. There were cases, however, where people were very reluctant. And the classic case was the interview with the guy who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, who was very suspicious, rightly, of what was Studs looking for and what was he going to say.
It was the atomic bomb, the first ever. And that particular moment is what changed the whole world around. Do you feel that so, that changed the world, that moment? How do you feel about it? You were the pilot of that plane.
Definitely. Yes, I was the pilot.
I kept the whole interview on purpose. We cut very little from it because it showed the method with which Studs gradually got to this guy to really talk about what he felt. And seeing Studs there was like watching a boxer. I mean, he was very good at feinting, at pulling back, at punching when he thought it would get there, not forcing the pace. He was really brilliant at getting past people's defenses, and on the whole, that worked very well.
It was named after your mother. It was originally called Number 82.
Yeah, well, I named it after her because she did not try to discourage me from flying. The next thing was I didn't want a duplication of names on airplanes, and I knew that there would no other airplane in the world could come out with that name.
How did your mother feel about her name?
Well, I can only tell you what my dad said. He said, when the telephone started ringing and so forth, you should have seen your mother. My mother was a quiet person. She never changed her expression very much about anything, whether it was serious or light, but she'd get tickled and her stomach would jiggle. He said, you should have seen the old gal's belly jiggle on that one.
And sitting with Paul Tibbetts, he and I are, shall we say, elderly gaffers. Two guys talking. He is 87, I'm 89, and I thank you very much indeed.
I thank you.
Thank you.
For being here.
That's terrific.
This is Hearing Voices with the Transom.org tribute to Studs Terkel, hosted by Transom editor and longtime Studs collaborator, Sidney Lewis.
While we were reminiscing about working with Studs, Lois Baum, who was the former associate program director, and George Drury, the former assistant record librarian, certain things about Studs came up. His uniform, that blue or gray blazer, the red check shirt, the red socks, the hush puppies that he wore until they stopped making them, which really upset him. A certain agitation in the air, excitement, noise when he was around, his deafness, which was often, when Lois and I were talking to him, selective. And those stinking cigars that he loved, and he smoked them everywhere, including the office. And it made the hallway, as Lois will tell you,
blue. Literally, the air was blue in the hallway where Studs and I and a few other people had our offices.
Was that ever resolved, Miss Grundy?
That's George chiming in with Studs' pet name for Lois.
No. Well, it was resolved, finally. No, it didn't work. I'd cut articles out of the newspaper that talked about secondary smoke and the dangers and all of that, and I would post them on his door with highlighting them and arrows pointing at them. It meant nothing to him, whatever. I think we had a fire or two in a wastebasket also a couple of times in the early years, which wasn't very good. He never stopped until he was quite old, but he did cut way back, and he stopped smoking at the office, which I have to say was a blessing.
I came around the corner once, and you were just finishing reading him the riot act about his cigar, and very affectionately he gave me this great look, and he said, yeah, she gets nervous.
Oh, dear.
And then there was his legendary mechanical ineptitude, which was based on a certain very real antagonistic relationship with technology, but also sometimes a useful ploy.
People think I'm deliberately doing this. I happen not to be good mechanically, as you know.
I bear witness.
I can't drive a car. I goof up on tape recorder. I press the wrong button. This one that was reel to reel, before the cassette reel to reel. The person interviewing me, who has never seen the tape, but sees something's wrong. I don't see it. Pardon me, sir, but that reel, that thing is not moving. Oh, I pressed, I'm sorry. Well, at that moment, that person feels pretty good, because I am not from Mount Olympus, from a TV network. On the contrary, I'm someone who kind of goofs up, not unlike that person. Now that I corrected, that person helped me. The person suddenly realize I needed him or her. So to feel needed is, of course, one of the sine qua nons of being a human. So my mechanical ineptitude is sometimes an asset to me.
He would act as if he couldn't do certain things around the office, like operate the postage machine.
The copy machine or the production studio tape recorder. Lois found out after her first few months that he was a bit of a faker. He had this way of asking, though, that would pull you right in.
Please, kid, I can't handle this machine. You know how to do these things.
And just because you knew it would please him to be helped, you would. But one day, Lois came around the corner and found him using the postage meter.
And I said, aha, you do know how to use the machine. And after that, I would never post any letters for him. And that was sort of a joke between us.
He did manage to master one machine, an old Underwood manual typewriter. Again, George Drury.
And one of the great fun things was to go into his office after he'd just banged out a letter to the editor. His reference level allowed him to really take people to task when he thought that they had done something low. I don't know if he ever mastered the computer, but he certainly had his old classic typewriter and had a nice percussive relationship with it.
For him, work and life were one thing, and he really made manifest his beliefs every day. He never regretted his political activities, even during the 50s, after his TV show Studs Place had been canceled and he'd been blacklisted. He had never had to testify in court. He told me that if he had been called, he hoped that he would have asserted the First Amendment. But it might have been the Fifth, because who knows how or why someone is going to react a certain way when they're in a jam. Those questions of why and how a person reacts were always key in his work. Here he is talking with documentary filmmaker Marcelo Fulz.
There's something that you've done in each of those films I've seen that makes it more than a traditional documentary as we know it, or cinema verite. And that's the person watching, myself, and I'm sure it applies to every member of the human species. Way in the back was my thing, hey, what about me if I were in that position? Would I be heroic as one or two were, or as, quote-unquote, craven or cowardly, as the great many were in this town? And that's the question. Suddenly you look into yourself. That's where your, if I may use this word, your art lies.
Well, if I may say so, Studs, incidentally, so does yours.
Part of that art, his ability to get us to reveal ourselves, was bound up with his empathy. He would talk about people's weaknesses, the frailties, he'd sometimes say. Here he is at the age of 90.
I guess I've learned about the vulnerability of all of us. Vulnerable. And I find individuals are all different, no matter what their ideology might be. I am, of course, a man of the left, they'd say. But I understand those others, too. You see, you have to. Because if these books were just aimed at liberal, they wouldn't be worth anything. So I hope there's some value, because it captures the feelings of all of us as individuals. What's it like to be a certain person in a certain circumstance at a certain time? The Depression book, for example. What's it like to be a kid seeing his father come home at 10 o'clock in the morning with his tool chest on his shoulder, and then it's on relief for the next 10 years? Welfare was called relief in those days. What's it like to be the little kid who's a mama's boy about hitting the shores of Normandy in 1944? What's it like to be a woman who has a job for the first time in her life, ironically because of the war and defense plans? So you learn about the, I guess, my own vulnerability as well. That's important too, I think.
When he and I collaborated on his second memoir, Touch and Go, he was 93, recovering from surgery and a long stretch in the hospital, and not so charitable about his own frailties and personal failings. He spoke ruefully about blurbs for authors that he hadn't written, letters he hadn't answered, harsh words spoken, and more private instances where he felt he could have been a much better person.
Was I a success? In other words, am I a success in things that really count deep down? The answer is no.
You're a human.
Well, yeah, I see. Now that's my easy way out. Human in many ways. And as human used as an excuse.
But you recognize...
Oh, I recognize that for a long time.
Well, that's...
I think about that very often.
And though he really loved to tell stories about his life and about himself, he didn't like to delve into his feelings a whole lot. Here he is in 1963 with Marlon Brando, who turned the tables and started interviewing him.
What is it about this particular kind of work that interests you? Why are you preoccupied with these questions? What is the nature of your search and your furrowing out this information from people of all kinds and all manner? What kind of contribution does it make to you as a person?
This is a reversal. It's a good question, Marlon Brando. I don't know. I suppose curiosity. I don't know. And there's a danger. This is a danger that I have of being too glib. I've got to watch this. Curiosity, I suppose. It's an easy way of saying it. I think in a way, in an indirect way, I can find out a little about myself, too. And again, this is also a dangerous way out. I'm inquisitive and curious. I'm not answering your question, Marlon, and yet perhaps I am in a way. I enjoy this work as much as one can within the framework in which we live. Other things I'd like to do. This is the form of confessional.
Again, former WFMT sales manager and friend, Tony Judge.
He was never a guy who was terribly comfortable with his own emotions, and never as hail fellow well-met as he could be, as warm and charming as he could be, and he was incredibly so. He was never a man perfectly comfortable in his own skin, as they say, and intimacy was difficult for him, even though he could evoke and provoke wonderfully intimate moment with others. I don't think he was ever particularly comfortable with that kind of stuff. His love for his father, which was short-term because of his father's early death, I think, was always very painful for him. Once again, it's part of the complex that was that interesting man.
What Studs was most comfortable with was being with people and talking to them, at them, with them. Editor Tom Englehart.
You have to imagine he's this little pint-sized guy who had something utterly expansive about him, expansive and inclusive. Studs, I think, was really two people. One was the professional listener. There was no better. The other Studs, the Studs you met socially or in public, didn't listen at all. He couldn't listen. Studs would walk into a room. He'd spot me there. He'd come over. I'm not that big, but he'd reach up and put his arm around me. He'd say, "Best editor this side of the Mississippi," or something like that. And then he'd go on talking. I always had the feeling with Studs in public like I was in a talk show. I was on Johnny Carson, and I was like the third person. I wasn't the person he was talking to. But he had you in it. You know, you sat there and listened. He didn't focus at all, unless in that crew he noticed somebody he could interview. And then it switched again. And all of a sudden, instead of yakking, he was asking questions.
Whether asking or talking, he did it with gusto. Lois Baum sometimes edited his programs.
Someone would say something, and he'd say, "Do you mean to tell me?" And then he'd say exactly what the person had just said. And I would say, "Studs, you don't need to repeat that." But he did need to repeat it, because that was part of his enthusiasm and his joy in what he was discovering about life. And he also wanted, in a way, to be able to convey that to the listener, that same enthusiasm.
His enthusiasm, his energy was incredible. He was a force of nature. When we were working on Touch and Go, as I said earlier, he was ailing. He wasn't very strong. But one day, he talked for 5 hours. 5 hours. I was ready to drop. During the final edit on books, Andre Schifrin would often come to Chicago and stay at the Turkle House.
You know, into his 96th year, he was still full of more them than most people one knows who had half his years.
You remember the voice of...
I don't know how he kept that up. I mean, I must say,
New York. He was
you know, I would be exhausted after a day with him. And, you know, when I went to the house to work with him, he would be, you know, knocking at my door at 7 in the morning saying, "All right, let's get to work."
And he gets excited. Let the kids get excited. And so off and Annie, here's what
and,
she did.
She went, and then it went Daddy on Warbucks, throughout went, the day.
Often, well, that's radio.
Yeah, I mean, he had a phenomenal amount of energy from the beginning to the very end.
And it did in 2008 when he died on Halloween. Studs' tremendous energy is gone. And for me, the world is sometimes a quieter, duller place. But we can still touch the electricity that was him through the work he left behind.
You know, like they say, when you've had a limb cut off, you still feel it. Every few days I think to myself, oh, I gotta call Studs.
There are satchels full of fantastic experience. He lives very large in my life.
He had a curiosity that never left him. It was the curiosity that we have as very young children.
That's the strongest thing that I remember. The openness, the accessibility, the availability to other human beings.
You never came away from Studs without feeling like a bigger, more expansive, better person. He included you in his largeness. You were somehow part of it, and it made you feel wonderful. Made you feel, that small man made you feel bigger than yourself.
It is how people feel when they read his books, like we're bigger than ourselves. He could make you feel better about humanity, but not in a phony way. Because always he acknowledged the best and the worst in people. Here's the end of that poem he was reading at the beginning of this hour, Gone Away Blues.
Oh, hygienic inventor of the bomb that's so clean. Oh, lily white senator from East Turnip Green. Oh, celestial mechanic of the money machine. I'm going someplace where nobody makes your scene. Goodbye. 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 Adios. Au revoir. So long. Sayonara. Do svidaniya. Ciao. Bye-bye. 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 I love that one. That's the best reading I've done on it, I think. Well, that's great. Hey, let's do more. Maybe now I gotta quit.
God knows I'll be waiting. Yes, I'll be watching.
Working with Studs was hosted and produced by Sidney Lewis of the public radio website Transom.org, with help from Vicki Merrick and me, Jay Allison, and with support from the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Ford Foundation, FordFoundation.org. Thanks to Samantha Brown, Hans Werner, Uli Swidler, Jesse Hardman, and the Chicago History Museum, and to WFMT Radio and WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station. At transom.org, you'll find lots of links to all things Studs Terkel. From Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Jay Allison for HearingVoices.com.
From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.